Right. So in the first few weeks of this program, we've talked a lot about methodologies for control, questions about feedback control versus open loop control and different paradigms for achieving control. But I think we all also agree that a very important goal for us is to think about how we characterize quantum systems, how we ultimately, once we actually do this control, how do we diagnose what we've done, how do we measure quantum systems. This is, I think, a very important challenge, especially as our systems become more and more complex, and that is the subject of this program, control of complex quantum systems. Now, one of the ways in which we think about doing that is tomography. Not saying that this is the only way or necessarily even the best way to do that, but what I want to explore in this talk today is some theory and some experiments done on doing quantum tomography on a fairly large Hilbert space system. Okay, this work was a very tight collaborative project with my friend and collaborator out in Tucson, Paul Yessen, who will be here for the conference and tell you a lot more about the experiment, and the thesis work of Carlos Riofrío on the theory side, who's now working with Jens Seisert out at the Free University in Berlin. Okay, so let's get started. So we all, I think, know, let me just remind you about the standard paradigm of quantum tomography. If we want to do state tomography on a quantum state row, well, we need many, many copies of that state to do it. And typically, one thinks about it in the following way. One typically thinks that you have these many copies somehow, some way, and on those copies, you do measurements on some set of observables. Okay, so we have some set of observables which are thought to be in some sense informationally complete in some precise way that we can define. And typically one imagines doing some set of projective measurements, although that's not necessary, and this talk is going to generalize beyond that. And you get some outcome for each observable. And then you have typically some measurement statistics, the frequency of occurrence of these different measurement outcomes, and you use that and you have some estimator which tries to give you the best guess at what rho naught was given these statistics. Okay, so that's the standard paradigm of quantum tomography. Now, we all know, I think, that this has many challenges, especially as the systems become more complex, as the dimension of the Hilbert space gets big. And so it's an extremely time-consuming process to do all of these measurements. The number of observables that you need grows quadratically with the size of the Hilbert space, and that can be if I have n qubits, this should be a little n, then that's exponential with the number of qubits if I have some tensor product structure. And there are some experimental challenges as well in terms of how you have to exactly prepare the same state over and over again. And this is generally a procedure that's not very robust to systematic errors. I mean, there's an assumption in the theory that you're measuring a certain observable. But in the lab, you're never actually measuring that observable exactly. If you think about an ion trap, you're measuring some fluorescence on some transition, and you say that's a measurement of sigma z, well, that's okay, but then I have to measure sigma x, and how do I do that? Well, I rotate the spin, maybe I don't rotate it exactly. So those are the system. Generally, it's not particularly robust to many kinds of systematic noise. So what we're going to look at today is thinking about doing this kind of tomography in a slightly different paradigm. that is in some sense based on what we think about when we do classical tomography. When you do classical tomography, generally what's being done in imaging is that you have some continuous measurement signal. You're sitting in your MRI machine and it's rotating the magnets around your head and taking pictures at different angles and then ultimately reconstructing the three-dimensional image of my pea brain over there. So the idea is to think about tomography from the context, from the point of view of continuous measurement. And so schematically, what we're going to consider here is that we have some ensemble that was prepared all at once in the same state. Okay, we can relax that, but let's just for the moment just imagine that's the case. And we're going to measure collectively the whole state. And we're going to then get some, there's some collective observable here that is being measured. Now, this is not a projective measurement, this is a generally noisy measurement. In this case, I'm imagining it, and we're going to see in the actual experiment, I'm probing this with some laser beam, and I get some, say, photo current. So what we measure here, then, there's some POVM described by POVM elements here, E sub x, and I get some probability of outcome x, given here related to the particular Krauss operators for this ancilla paradigm. And it's a noisy measurement. So it's in this case, if I have something like a laser beam, this would be the shot noise on the laser beam. Okay? And that noisy measurement then is Gaussian, has this Gaussian noise. Of course, as sigma gets very, very small, this limits to a projective measurement of this variable. Uh-oh, I haven't backed up in who knows how long. right, that's because I've been here. Right. Okay, so there's another aspect to this, which is that we're going to assume in this situation that this measurement is weak, that this is very noisy in the following sense, that the noise here is so big, this delta is so big, compared to the fluctuations in the measurement outcome that would come from the ensemble, that the measurement back action is negligible. Okay? So that it will just simplify the situation in a substantial way, but it always confuses people when I give this talk. I mean, how are you able to do, there's always measurement back action. Of course, that's true, but the amount can be absolutely negligible because I have many, many copies of the system all at once, and that the fluctuation, my measurement outcome, is going to be dominated by the noise on the probe rather than the quantum uncertainty of the state. Okay, so what we're going to do, there's control involved in this paradigm here, and the idea then is to drive the system in some well-defined way, in such a way that we get new information about the state that we, the initial state that we wanted to reconstruct in our measurement signal. And this is actual data. So the idea is look at these bumps and wiggles and somehow determine what was the initial state of the system. Okay, so it's a inversion problem. Determine the initial state of the system given the measurement record. Okay, so to be concrete, we'll look at this, mathematical paradigm in a concrete physical setting, and our setting here is going to be looking at the state of the spin of a cesium atom. Okay, so cesium has hyperfine structure and it has 16 magnetic sublevels in the magnetic in the electronic ground state. So we're going to be thinking about a 16-dimensional Hilbert space. And the system is driven with a combination of just magnetic fields coming from these coils and a microwave horn that's shining on this cloud of atoms, okay? And this cloud of atoms is our ensemble of identically prepared systems. So the way we control this is through the combination of these magnetic fields that are oscillating at RF frequencies, and what they do is we have a coil along the X direction, the Y direction, there's this green and purple coils, and they cause rotations of the spin, the irreducible representations of SU2 for F equals 3 and F equals 4. Okay? So they're just Larmor processing the spins. In addition, we have this microwave, which is resonantly tuned to this transition, which is a SU2 rotation on this subspace. And so the combination of these two, it turns out, makes the system controllable. That is, in the sense we've been talking about, this is a case of open loop control. That is to say, I want to generate an arbitrary SU16 matrix on this 16-dimensional Hilbert space. I have this control Hamiltonian that's parameterized by three control waveforms. The phases, we keep the amplitude pegged to the maximum possible power we can crank out, and the frequency is fixed, and all we do is modulate the phase of these three fields, and that's sufficient. In fact, it's more than enough. We actually only needed one coil, and that would also make the system controllable. And then the goal, an open loop control problem, is to optimize your fidelity for what you want to achieve. That is, say, find the waveforms that do the job. Okay? So the system's controllable, and here's just a quick example of the kind of control, just as what you get out of the computer and what works excellently in the laboratory. So the way we do it is that we just make the phase, we search for phases that are piecewise constant. So they change every 20 microseconds, and we search for these three phases. And here's what the Schrodinger equation gives you. So this is that was our initial state as the density matrix, and now we're showing the evolution of the elements of the density matrix. They're actually the absolute value of the density matrix elements, because of course they're generally complex. And you see, you know, the usual kind of thing. It goes all over the place, but at the end of the day, you get perfect control of the system. Okay? So now the goal is to do tomography. Okay, so we've made this state, let's do tomography on this state. So the way we're going to do that is by continuous measurement of the polarization of a probe that passes through the light. So we've made this, passes through the atoms. We've made the state, and now we want to probe its spin. And the way we do it is we use the Faraday effect. The Faraday effect is a classical optical effect whereby the polarization of a linear polarization of a plane wave will rotate by an amount depending upon the magnetization along the direction of propagation. So quantum mechanically, that's just this ideal entangling unitary between the collective projection of angular momentum of the spin and a component of the Stokes vector of the light. Okay? And so by monitoring how the polarization rotates in a polarimeter, we're measuring the collective FZ. In atomic physics, we like to call the hyperfine angular momentum F. And so this is the collective observable we're going to measure. Okay? So now we have, you know, the ideal paradigm to think about a weak measurement. We have an entangling unitary. The ancilla in some state, we want to find it in some other state. This is the Krauss operator. It's well approximated as a Gaussian because this is a laser beam with shot noise. And so there's a shot noise resolution of my detector, which depends on how big my rotation angle is and how many photons I have. And then there's projection noise having to do with something having to do with the uncertainty in the spin, the quantum fluctuations of FZ. But as I emphasized before, we're going to work in a regime where this is huge compared to this. And so as long as we have done this for a short enough time, so we haven't resolved the projection noise within the shot noise, then we're fine. Obviously, eventually, we're going to get into a regime of strong back action. That's how you make a spin squeeze state, for example. However, we actually can't get into that regime in this experiment because decoherence kicks in well before squeezing comes. So we never go that far. Yeah?
Do you have any estimate of the inhomogeneity?
Sure, we do. And I'll come to that in a moment. That's certainly important. So let me hold off on that question. Yeah.
Feeling for the separation of these scales between the back action, the shot noise, and the decoherence.
Right. Let me see how to quantify that and phrase that. The comparison is we can compare these two resolution scales, the shot noise resolution versus the back action resolution. This is about 10 times bigger than this. And at the point that decoherence starts to become important. So before that, it's, I don't know, many, many times bigger. Of course, you know, if you wanted to make this a regime where back action is important, then you would have to make a situation where more of the photons are scattered into the beam than diffusely scattered. That's the regime of high optical density, and that's how the experiments like Eugene Polzik and Morgan Mitchell and others have made their spin squeezing. You need to have a very optically dense sample to make your Faraday rotation signal dominate over your diffuse scattering. We're working on that too, that's another story. Okay, so now we have our, these are our PLVM elements that come from our measurement model, and this is the probability distribution of seeing a certain measurement outcome given the state at some time t. Okay? And so in the weak back action regime, essentially all the fluctuations that you see in your measurement outcome are dominated by the shot noise. They're not coming at all from the noise in the atoms. So it's essentially a mean field theory, where we're just seeing the mean of the collective spin. We're not seeing any of the fluctuations around that. And so this stochastic measurement record that comes out of our polarimeter has noise that's surely due to shot noise. It doesn't have anything to do with the state of the atoms, only the state of the light. And its mean value of this signal is determined by the expectation value of the observable for one of the atoms at time t. All right? So the goal now is, given this stochastic measurement record, determine what the initial state was. That's our tomography goal. All right, so how are we going to do it? So we have our measurement record, and we have our evolution, which is generated by the control waveforms that we're going to generate to make our tomographic measurement signal. So the way we do it is turn this continuous measurement record into a countable set of measurement outcomes by just discretizing time over some integration time of the detector. So we have now a discrete measurement record, and we parameterize rho as a generalized block vector. So we have some orthogonal matrices, and this is the trace of rho, which of course, if it's normalized, this is 1 over the dimension of the Hilbert space. Okay, so now this is turned into a so-called stochastic linear estimation problem. We have a stochastic measurement record, and we want to determine these parameters, the block vector of the initial state. Oh, I guess I forgot, I didn't emphasize that we're working here in the Heisenberg picture. So in the Heisenberg picture, the observables we measure at different times are changing, and the state is fixed. Okay. So the key ingredient, this comes to your question, Ali. The key ingredient to making this work well is that we know exactly the dynamics of what the different observables that we're measuring at every different time interval. Which means we need to know the dynamics as well as we possibly can. So all the uncertainty in your measurement record is dominated by the information you don't know about the initial state, not the information about what you don't know about the dynamics. This comes to the question of systematic errors. So one of the errors that Ali alluded to is the fact we have this ensemble of atoms, and we have a laser beam in there, and there's a magnetic field, and there's a gradient of the magnetic field across the sample. We need to include all of that. But those are things that we can calibrate beforehand, and we do that. So we can look at what the light shifts are across the atom. We can look at what the effects of the gradients of magnetic field. We estimate all of those things and put that to the best degree that we possibly can into the model, so that this is, it's really not identical ensemble members. They're undergoing slightly different dynamics across the inhomogeneity of the sample. Okay, so how are we going to reconstruct the state given that measurement record? We have now a conditional probability. The probability of getting these measurement outcomes at these times given the initial state is this Gaussian. And so the easiest thing to do, the most straightforward thing to do, is a maximum likelihood estimate to just look for the peak of this Gaussian. Of course, because of the noise, the shot noise on the sample, it's not guaranteed that the peak of this Gaussian is a physical state. It can have negative eigenvalues. So you need to constrain that. It's a constrained maximum likelihood, constrained that the state is positive. But we can do other things with this measurement record. So one of the things we've done is to do so-called compressed sensing. Now, compressed sensing has become a reasonably hot topic in quantum tomography these days. It's an idea that comes from classical processing of data. For example, you want to, when you take a picture with your digital camera, you take it with lots of pixels, but then ultimately it goes to JPEG. And why did you bother taking all those pixels if you knew at the end of the day you were going to throw most of them out? So if you have some prior information about the nature of images, you can compress your sensing, not just compress after the fact. And the same idea has been now applied in the context of quantum tomography. I don't really have time to explain that, but I can talk about it more in the questions if we like, by the whole group of collaborators, Gross et al., Steve Flamia, Jens Iser, a few others. And the idea is that if the state is low rank, or let's just, for our sake of argument here, say it's very close to a pure state, then you can find, we know that pure states require fewer parameters to describe. If the dimension is D, there are 2D minus 2 parameters, real parameters, that specify a pure state, whereas there are D squared minus 1 for an arbitrary mixed state. And if we expect that the state is close to pure, then We can get a good tomographic estimate of the state by, in fact, trying to minimize the rank of the matrix consistent with it. Now, that turns out to be an NP-hard problem. You can't do that. But a convex hull for that is the trace of the matrix. And that's a convex program that you can then optimize. So the idea here is to let the trace of the matrix be free. Minimize the trace of the matrix. Now, where the hell did the data go? Well, the data, what you have to do is assume, you fix in a way that's not obvious. You have to have some threshold. You say the data is close to my expected value of the data within some threshold epsilon. That is some measure of what your expected uncertainty is between the data and your model of what the data should be. So this would be, say, set by the shot noise in our problem. Of course, it also has to be positive in Hermitian. Okay? So we do both of these things. Now, what compressed sensing is supposed to do is give you a tomographic estimate of the state with fewer measurement settings. That is to say, instead of measuring d squared minus 1 orthogonal observables, I need to only, if it's a pure state, I only have to measure of order d log d. And if d is very big, that's a big improvement. Okay, so we're going to see how that performs in 6-parameter. Yeah?
So it would seem if you just want to have something which has low rank that you'd want to maximize trace row squared so it looks more pure. Is there a reason why you wouldn't do that, or is it just more difficult?
Let's see. So the trace, of course, is actually fixed at the end. I mean, the matrix is a state with a certain rank. We allow, if I knew the trace was 1, I was looking, if I had the true matrix entries, and I knew the trace of this matrix was 1, then if I look for the states with minimum rank with the fixed rank 1, I mean with the fixed trace 1, are inside that convex ball. Now I have to think about that for trace row squared in terms of why they don't do that. But I don't really know the answer to that question. But it was proven by Candace and the folks at Caltech who work on this that this is that there is this logarithmic overhead to get the exact matrix completion. Yeah?
So the advantage of tracing row restricted trace row squared is that you're looking for the answer in the first part in the sense that here we have a low rank.
Mm-hmm.
And the geometry of this trace row has a sharp geometry. If we look at it, it has sharp edges. And because we can go and find the sparse solution. But row squared is kind of curvy, kind of fine. So I can tell you more. But the theory is available for.
That's right, yeah. So it's the nature of the convex set that makes this powerful. I don't really know the geometry enough to give you a clear answer. But
if we had rho squared, then the linear program would be complete. It's that sort of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's also linear. Yeah, that's a good point.
I found my row.
Yeah.
It's got trace row less than 1.
And then I renormalize it.
Just renormalize.
That's correct. That's correct.
In the obvious way.
You said trace row equal 1.
And this this nominal expectation value that you're minimizing, that is with or without the renormalization of row?
No, so you allow row to the trace here.
That part's fine, no, it's the right, the constraint.
Yeah, in this case you allow, in this constraint you allow the trace to be arbitrary.
Got it, so I'm not dividing by trace row.
No.
Suppose I find a find my row has trace row equals 0.1. Now I read normal.
Yep.
Now my hems look like they're going to be way off.
But you see, the trace of row doesn't in any way appear in the signal, other than an overall calibration for the size of the signal. We've already taken that out in N here, because we had N copies of the sample.
I think we're thinking about the same problem, which is simply that I'm minimizing trace on the left-hand side, but on the right-hand side, because MI is not being changed in amplitude, I need a large trace.
But these are all traceless matrices, you see. Or sub I's.
Are you allowed to make unitaries under the trace?
Well, the O sub I's are evolving. They started as traceless matrices. F sub Z is a traceless matrix. The unitary evolution preserves that. Even if we have dissipation, that preserves that. So the trace of row never appears in the signal here. It has no role in the signal. All we have is the number of atoms.
Is it true that when I renormalize row, trace row OI is unchanged?
That's correct. Because these are traceless matrices, the O sub I's. Okay, so as was discussed, the important point here is that we can solve this efficiently via convex optimization. So instead of minimizing the rank, we minimize the trace. Now, one thing I didn't mention to you is how are we going to generate our informationally complete set? Because I had to somehow drive the system. Well, that's actually a hard problem that we don't know exactly how to optimize. What we do kind of intuit that is that we want to have a Haar random covering of all observables sort of uniformly in operator space. So what we do, and we find empirically this works well, is that the waveforms, those three waveforms that I discussed earlier and when it was used to do state preparation, here are the waveforms that are being used to do tomography, we just pick random phases which generates random unitaries. Perhaps not with the measure we want, but it is sufficient. Okay, I'm going to skip this because it's not so important and go to now showing you the data. So here's an example where we, using control, optimal control, we drove the system with a set of phases that made a particular target state. Now you say, what the heck is that target state? That target state is a Haar random state, but it's a known one, the one that we wanted to make. Okay? It's got matrix elements all over the place. Now what's being shown in this unfortunately light curve here is what we expect the measurement signal to look like, which we can simulate, given this state. Okay, so we know what we start with this row naught, we drive the system, we look at the polarimeter, we put in the inhomogeneities, we put in the kitchen sink, and this is what the measurement record should be. Now I'm going to show you what the data is, and as the data comes up, I'm going to show you what our two algorithms give us in terms of the reconstruction as a function of time. So here we go. Oh, I should say, in order to look at this, it's easier to look at this in a different basis, where this is one of the eigenvectors. So I'm just going to rotate it so that the Haar random matrix is on the diagonal, so it's just in the Haar base, so we can't really see it otherwise. So let me just look at it. Oops, in a different basis. Okay, so that's the Haar random state we want to make, and go. So that's the actual data. This is not here to guide your eye. You'll see there are some slight differences between the data and our expected value of the data. But it's darn good. We know these dynamics pretty darn well. And this is how the reconstruction is working as a function of time for this particular state. Okay. So there's a number of things to say about that. Obviously, we're very proud of the fact that these two curves lie on top of each other so amazingly. And this was years of work. I mean, hand and glove theory and experiment to make this work. You know, this is Carlos's thesis. And the guys in Tucson, but anyway. sorry, guys in Tucson. But the point here is that the experiment is so well controlled that it does what our models are telling, and we know how to include the imperfections. Now, the other thing you see here, this is for one particular state, you see how the system, how it rose as a function of time. The ultimate fidelity for this state, this is about I think it's like 92, and this is like 88% fidelity in our reconstruction. And those, if we look at this average, what was done in the laboratory was doing this for about 50 different random, hard random states, doing the same thing and averaging. Oh, before I say that, again, I want to emphasize, so here are just different cases of what our measurement record looks like for different random, hard random states. And you could see that there is excellent agreement. And each one of these we think about as a fingerprint. Each one of them is a kind of unique representation of what this initial state was. Okay, so I'm getting to the end here. This is the data shown averaged over 48 different hard random states. The blue here is the compressed sensing. The red is our least squares maximum likelihood, constrained maximum likelihood. What we see in this is that there's not that big of a difference in the performance between the two in this case. Moreover, what we see, if we just fit a exponential rise of the fidelity for this time interval for times less than 1 millisecond, what we see is that they basically have the same time constant on them. So this idea in this particular case that the compressed sensing gives us the information faster than the least squares, we do not find to be true in this experiment. It is not the case. Which surprised us and confused the heck out of us. What we do see, which is a different idea, is that, so it goes to your question, Ali. Suppose that we didn't model the inhomogeneity. Suppose that we just said, hey, we have this great laser beam, it's so uniform, and there's no inhomogeneities. We don't put that into our model so that we have the wrong observables as a function of time, slightly, because of this, we left out the inhomogeneity in our model. What we find is that the compressed sensing drops off a little bit, but the least square drops off a lot. So we find in this experiment, in this methodology, that the power of compressed sensing is not in the rate at which you gain information, but in the robustness to imperfections, to systematic errors. And that's because we think a couple of reasons. So this now gets to the last couple of slides, the conjecture. Yeah.
Sure. So if you want to improve asymptotic fidelity, the most efficient way of doing that is what, different observables? Or if you really wanted to reach, say, 100%, well, do some limiting situation where you're approaching 100%.
Well, what limits our fidelity here is our ability to exactly model the dynamics. So there is systematic error that we have not properly put into our system. There's some, the decoherence is playing almost no role in this. The photon scattering is not an important, the time constant is, you know, way out here, 10 times bigger.
Okay, so perfectly modeled, you get to 100.
We would. So what limits our fidelity here is systematic noise. What we're saying is that the compressed sensing is more robust to our inability to model that. And that's because of the fact that, if I go back to this, there's wiggle room. You see, the least squared tries to find the state that gets your signal as close to what your expected value of the signal is. If there's noise in this, then that's going to really contaminate your estimate of rho. But in compressed sensing, you're not minimizing this distance. You're just saying it's within some known noise interval. And you're allowing wiggle room. You're just saying it's close to pure or has low rank. Now, that makes sense to us. Why there's robustness in some sense built into compressed sensing that's not in this least squared estimate. But what's a little puzzling still is why we didn't see a difference in the rate of increase, which is what the whole compressed sensing was really supposed to be about. Well, I think the answer, at least part of the answer to that, is that compressed sensing was taken from this idea of matrix completion that was studied in the classical engineering literature. Was about general matrices. But our matrices are not general matrices, they're positive matrices, and they have a different geometry. And the point here is that the compressed sensing is supposed to work well when the state is close to pure. But when the state is close to pure, there's a highly constrained set of matrix elements that are consistent with the data. Not any old matrix elements, but only certain ones are consistent with the state being a physical state. And so, because positivity is built into the least squares does very well too. It rises very fast. In fact, if we leave positivity out and looked at the Hilbert-Schmidt distance rather than fidelity, because you can't do fidelity if you leave out positivity, then we would find it wouldn't work. So there's another, this is, I think, one answer. I know we're running out of time, so I'm going to skip this and just get to my conclusions and say, well, there's more work to be done. This is what we're learning here is that by doing things via continuous weak measurement, we can do tomography much faster and more robustly than has been done often. We find that compressed sensing, its power in this case lies in its robustness to uncertainty rather than the rate at which we gain information. And we really are now trying to understand where the differences between these two estimators come from. Under what conditions do you really get a lot more power out of compressed sensing versus least squared? I think that's not a done deal. I think that we still a lot of work for us to do to think about that. And we're also trying to apply these two questions of process tomography. Ali has done some very nice work on that, and we're looking at that as well. Continuous measurement context. So I guess I will stop there.
Thank you very much. That makes me very, very happy again that I was not able to hire Carlos, the author of this fantastic work here. But that's fine. We had already several questions. Are there any more questions?
So this is a question broadly about compressed sensing.
Okay.
Rather than specifically about the wonderful results that you're showing. And it has to do with this D log D scaling.
Okay.
So in your particular case, you're looking at a scenario where you have this D log D scaling, but it's not the whole D, it's just individual particle D, because you're assuming the product state. I'm kind of curious if there are extensions to compressed sensing of P people have thought about extensions to compress sensing under sort of matrix product state ensembles rather than product state ensembles. Because presumably the well, D would grow to the rank of the matrix product state, which is obviously much
sure. Let's see how should I answer that. You know, typically, so what? When one is saying one wants to do tomography on a state row, one imagines one has many copies. Typically, one does that sequentially. You can ask the question, if I can have all of the copies all at once, and I could do arbitrary collective measurements on all those ensembles, what's sort of the best I could do? So certain things are known about that, sort of what's the optimal average fidelity I can make if I had arbitrary collective measurements. Your question is a slightly different one. Your question is, what if I'm given a many-body state that is not in a product state, but in something that's weakly entangled, for example, like a matrix product state, and I want to, well, what am I doing tomography of? We know that I can't do, so we know if I wanted to measure the full many-body state, I'd need many copies of that many-body state. But if I want to measure some low correlation functions of many-body state, can I do that with one copy or two copies? Very interesting. Certainly we're thinking about that. I mean, it's a natural, one way.
More efficiently.
Right, indeed. I mean, the point here is that we can, the back action issue that we were discussing a moment ago, or I mentioned, is because we have many, many, many copies, the back action is distributed across the ensemble. And similar kind of thing would be true if I say I wanted to measure the two-body effect. Suppose I wanted to measure two-body correlations. Then I have many copies of those two bodies. And can I efficiently gather that information? So I think that's an interesting question, something we're working on right now. The compressed sensing, I don't think that's been looked at exactly for that problem, but I think it's a very interesting one.
Okay, so thanks again. I think we are ready for the next speaker. Thank you, Akhenaten.
Do you need this?